G'day listeners, I'm Edgars Grester and you're listening to The Business of Biodiversity. Did you know that over half the world's population, that's more than 4 billion people, now live in urban areas? As our population grows, so does our urban development. This concrete sprawl is negatively impacting biodiversity in these changing ecosystems. But it's not all doom and gloom. In this episode, we'll hear how three businesses are bringing nature back into the urban jungle to help communities and wildlife thrive. From DIY residential gardens to commercial-scale green walls and bio-solar roofs, as well as indigenous cultural landscape design. All three have different approaches, but there's a shared end vision. Plant a rich variety of native species that will encourage biodiversity and make our urban environment hum a green tune.
Hi, I'm Liz.
And I'm Erin.
And we are the co-owners of Bushy Landscapes.
We're basically a landscape company that is quite driven from an ecological standpoint, in that we're wanting to use land management restoration practices in the residential sphere for landscapes, basically. So we're wanting to kind of invite the bush into residential gardens as much as possible. And our core mission, I suppose, is to deliver a high-end, locally native garden to that residential sector.
So with each landscape, you're designing a garden that's specific to that area.
Yeah, that's right. And so when we build these gardens, we use the species that exist in those plant community types, which is kind of your first step. And then you can actually move on to getting a mix of plants that would be true to what you'd find in the correct ratios, if you will, kind of in that bushland.
And Erin says that when you match the right native plants with local soils, it can mean really low maintenance.
It's interesting actually planting a truly local native garden, and if you're lucky enough to have remnant soils, just how fantastically they grow. Zero irrigation, zero kind of input really. Pop the plants in and you're away.
For Erin and Liz, working this way isn't just about low maintenance gardening, but about restoring local ecosystems that have been dramatically transformed by urbanisation.
We have a client in Terry Hills called Justine, and that area, a lot of ecologists and locals would know, it's the only area in Australia that you'll find the Duffy's Forest plant community type. So this is an endangered ecological plant community type. It only exists in a very small area surrounding Terry Hills and Duffy's Forest, those suburbs up there.
The Duffy's Forest ecological community originally extended over about 1,450 hectares, but now has only approximately 240 hectares of woodland left. Some of the threats to these communities include land clearing and development, weed invasion, and inappropriate fire regimes, as well as other impacts like physical damage from inappropriate access, like people walking and riding horses, trail bikes, and other vehicles. So when the opportunity came up, Liz and Erin were really keen to restore this local native habitat.
So when we were engaged to kind of create a locally native garden by Justine, we kind of brought to her attention that her land was on this special plant community type, and that would like to kind of be quite true to those species. And she was, of course, instantly on board. She's a wildlife carer, so she's already kind of got a lot of passion in that area, I suppose. We ended up replicating Duffy's Forest to the T. Every species we used would be found locally in those plant community types. And the very special one being Grevillea kalii, which is critically endangered. Popped three of those in the garden and growing fantastically.
Yep. We also introduced her to Grevillea kalii because she wasn't actually aware of, you know, that significance and that flower. So that was a very exciting moment for her. And, you know, she's lived there for a really long time, and, you know, a lot of people, they don't know about this plant. So that was a very special, exciting moment for us. A huge honour to work on both that community that is threatened under state level and the plant that's threatened under state and federal.
The Duffy's Forest ecological community is just one of over 100 ecological communities recognised as threatened in New South Wales. For Erin and Liz, not only are they restoring native habitat for local animal species, they're creating connection between the burbs and the bush for residents.
A short walk down the road and you can actually access that bush in its true form, and you're seeing those exact plants growing and the animals interacting in that community. And we've already, this garden's been in coming up to 2 years now, And we're already having, you know, animals moving through and, you know, having great results, plants living on those soils, because the soils in the garden were remnant. Amazing seeing that plant kind of really enjoy being in its kind of home soil. That was incredible. The soils up there are a specific blend of kind of laterite. They're very high in iron, very low in nutrients and very acidic. So, yeah, you do have these very select parameters that are often nowhere near your standard residential garden when soils have been impacted. So yeah, luckily enough, this garden we popped in, those soils were relatively remnant, and yeah, the results are amazing. If you, as long as you're not straying too far from what was there originally, you know, obviously you get quite good results.
The strength of matching local plants to local soils can also be its weakness. As Erin said, many soils have been altered because of urbanisation, and part of their work involves recreating the right conditions for local gardens to thrive.
I suppose that's a big part of our business as well. We need these products to be replicatable. We need these gardens to be achievable, regardless of whether that soil's high quality remnant or not. So yeah, we've done quite a bit of work in sourcing certain products, soil blends that suit the species that we're trying to get in.
Getting the soil condition right is critical for the success of these plants, which act as both a food source and habitat for local native animals. But attracting these creatures into residential spaces has its own issues.
So as much as practically possible, we've created habitat that would support the local animals of the area, 100%. And that's through kind of dense layering of shrubs and a selection of species that would help to kind of create cover specifically for animals, such as birds, really, being the priority. So it's hard in the residential sector. You have cats, dogs. There's a lot of kind of elements at play there. And there's a little bit of a kind of moral dilemma in, you know, do we want to invite these animals into the residential space, encourage them into an area where they might be more heavily predated upon. But yeah, we kind of, we try to manage that as best we can. We usually, we're targeting species like birds, small wrens, and select species of local honey eaters that need very specific flower types to get basically the nectar they need. So by targeting those species, we feel like it's a little bit more appropriate than actually other mammals and different animals coming through.
The connection between fauna and flora also really demonstrates the importance of these threatened local habitats. Erin and Liz aren't just planting trees and shrubs, they're also planting seeds of knowledge for the local residents. As native birds return to Justine's garden, she's experienced firsthand how threatened species play a role in our ecosystem and why they're so important.
That's been a great experience, and she's been loving really connecting with that. And she's quite the whiz now on all the local plants and species. And yeah, it's been a really nice experience to kind of replicate that community.
I'm interested to know, for people like yourself who are passionate about restoring threatened species, where does that spark come from? Is it something that's happened more recently in life or something earlier on in your youth?
Did my training in bush regeneration right out of school. I have a bit of family lineage there. I know my father and my grandmother were both bush regenerators. Quite nice. I'm kind of a third generation. So that passion for conservation was instilled in me pretty young.
And I'm an ecologist, and I've just been in the bush religiously for 10 years. So I changed my career, studied ecology, and joined Aaron. He is very convincing on the whole thing.
I was brought up in Castle Crag, and there's a lot of history there about conservation and people living closely with the environment. My grandmother, Beverly Blacklock, she was quite an early advocate of, I suppose you could say, bush regeneration in its earliest form, the stuff that was pioneered by the Bradley sisters, who she actually worked in on a few projects, including some work through Manly Dam. Yeah, and she created a really strong community in her suburb and rallied a lot of people to get into the bush and to begin cleaning it up, which was quite exciting back then in the 70s and 80s.
Growing up amongst a community of bush regenerators was a great foundation for Erin, but it was actually stepping outside that environment and working in housing construction that made him realise that not everyone sees the world like he does.
it's funny being in the world of bush regeneration and conservation. Yeah, it can be a little bit of an echo chamber. You've got a lot of people who are very switched on and very kind of aware. And then you move into that residential landscape sphere where people are absolutely no idea what constitutes local natives. And that's where I kind of saw that missing link, I suppose.
Erin sees that people are really keen to plant native species in their gardens, but local knowledge is limited, and that there's a real opportunity to share this information with the community.
The information is difficult, and a lot of people asking for kangaroo paws again and again and again, which grow naturally a very long way away. Western Australia is almost a different place, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's what inspired me, and just working in that field, I thought I could do my best to have a crack and fill that niche.
Urban development has transformed the landscape around us so dramatically. And the work Erin and Liz are doing around the suburbs of Sydney, it's kind of like nature's version of a historic home restoration, where there's lots of digging into the history archives of how things used to be.
Yeah, local knowledge and historical records are key to the process. And this project was an exciting time for us. So we worked with our client Lisa and Ross on a community called Sydney Turpentine Ironbark Forest. And it's a very, I guess, upsetting issue, as there's only 0.5% left within Sydney. And it only occurs in Sydney. They wanted us to do a native garden. And I don't think they were really knew what they were getting themselves into with us. So that was a really thorough process for us. We did our surveys and looking at the different data on the area, both historically and ecologically. And then we consulted local knowledge that, you know, comes down to, you know, has someone lived in Camperdown for 30 years and they know that, oh, yes, there was an ironbark on that corner. So then we explored different reserves with our clients, and we also went all across Sydney to each tiny little patch, and I really enjoyed seeing the variation, whether that was variation in strata or variation in species across the different communities. So, yeah, it was really solidifying for us and how we, I guess, initially get that concept together.
There's a lot of knowledge to gather and rediscover, but that's only the start of the journey. For Liz and Erin, another challenge in recreating these local habitats is just finding the right plants to propagate.
The next stage, once we get designing, sourcing the plants is a really huge issue for us and a real limitation to where, I guess, native landscaping and even bush regeneration is currently at. I mean, bush regeneration, you know, they heavily use one type of grass, one type of wattle in areas that need that diversity. So I guess overall this supply issue affects both industries and has, yeah, massive effect on how we revegetate.
It was interesting coming up against that for this community type, Stiff being quite, Sydney Turpentine Ironbark Forest being quite, they're more difficult species to propagate and to get a hold of. So we really had to go to the ends of the earth and source a lot from local nurseries and beg a lot of local growers to kind of let us in and access these species in you know, reasonable numbers, I suppose. And
We spent a year getting together these plants.
Oh, wow. And yeah, truly.
We can only get these plants very small. No one's selling them to us big. We're not going commercial. We're asking, you know, Dan down the road who has a passion for, acacia pubescens. I don't know. You're like, I got to go beg Dan for his 3 tube stock, so a very small plant. You know, there's a lot to, I guess, navigate with this aspect. And yeah, I guess it's its own skill, and it's something that we are quite good at. I guess we know the local growers, and we've been building rapport with them, I'd say, over the last 3 years, and we're pre-ordering the species that we know will take quite a long time. And as a business, we're putting our sort of our bet on these plants that we don't even know will go in the ground, but we just know if we did need them, we're going to need 2 years growing time to maybe even get a meter of a certain species in. I don't think you know that how long these commercial nurseries are holding certain plants for. You know, you really don't know the value and time it's taken to grow a 3 meter plant.
The challenge for nurseries, as for many businesses, is around supply and demand. And Erin says that that challenge really increases when it comes to propagating really niche native species.
You know, it's a very difficult problem that has its roots kind of in the practicality of propagation, but also kind of, I suppose, trends in, at least in the residential sphere. So, yeah, it's definitely a tricky one. The government definitely invests. I suppose local government are putting a lot of money and energy into local nurseries, which we rely heavily on to access a lot of our stock. And so do those local governments in their revegetation projects and whatnot. Sourcing the stock from the area itself is quite important for genetic accuracy and all those sorts of things.
We do have our own sort of nursery, and we have been kind of pushed into a corner where, you know, we have to source things in advance and hold them here and grow them and find seed and, you know, grow, fill the gaps where plants we know we're not going to get. So Sydney Turpentine Ironbark Forest, there's only one commercial nursery that would touch a few of those species. So we're up against lots of challenges.
Nurseries are a little bit like a fashion house for flora in that they stock what's in style, but they also drive the style by choosing what to grow and then what's available.
It's definitely an issue that we'd love to, you know, potentially tackle in our own little way one day, setting up a nursery that could service an area as large as Greater Sydney and really provide access to plants across a large set of plant community types, high quality plants in various growth stages, so that contractors and companies might be able to better engage with this concept of ecological style gardening or landscaping, or just, you know, getting these species back in the right spots.
Liz and Erin's vision for bushy landscapes is to be a conduit of plants and knowledge, not only for companies working in the landscaping space, but also for individual residents looking to restore their own local patch. Because in a time of climate uncertainty and ongoing threats to our native biodiversity, it feels good to know our actions can make a difference.
The clients really engage with the gardens that they're given, I suppose. We identify what bush would have existed on their land, and instantly, bang, their garden has a sense of purpose. It has a name, has something we can, it has a list of species that we can, you know, obviously use and celebrate. And yeah, we've found it really effective, even just people walking out and realizing what would have been there and what's kind of there again in a different way.
What an opportunity for us as a society to, you know, get this right. Like, how can we, I don't know, achieve it all? How can we make sure that they stay and, you know, we make X new amount of homes for a growing city? We're sympathetic to, I guess, both causes and excited to be part of that.
Researchers recognise that cities can play a significant role in fostering biodiversity. The recent State of the Environment report identified that Australian towns and cities are home to 96% of our population and 46% of threatened species. Cities play an integral role when planning for and managing threatened species. GWA is an Indigenous company specialising in cultural landscape and design. A team of environmentalists intent on disrupting current methodologies in green infrastructure and green space design. Founder and director Clarence Slocke is a Kanjanbara and Bundjalung man with a long family history of bushmen, farmers and fishermen. Clarence intertwines his love of plants, education, culture and the arts into his work on green space design.
My background's Bundjalung, which is the far north coast, but it's, you know, I guess all First Nations people, whether it's Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander or First Nations people from the Americas or any of people around the world, we're all connected to country and we're all connected to our Earth Mother. And, you know, I think in some ways a lot of First Nations people still maintain that connection, even though they may not be living on country. Generally, as a species, we are continually moving further away. We're being further disconnected from our Earth Mother and from what it means to be connected. So, you know, the connection to green space is essential, really.
GWA developed and maintains the Cultural Landscape Garden at the South Everleigh Precinct, just outside Sydney CBD, along with members of the local Indigenous community. Diversity is a key feature, with a strong focus on Sydney region plantings and vulnerable species, creating a beautiful space and an urban seed bank.
The space was, for a long time, the industrial hub of Sydney, I suppose. There were a lot of factories. It's now being redeveloped into an innovation hub and some very large buildings. But, my company's been tasked with looking after the green space in that precinct. Interestingly, from a landscape perspective, there are the hard spaces and the formal garden beds that run between buildings and shared pathways, for example. Those formal garden beds, we're looking at ways that we can increase the plant species, because by increasing the plant species, you automatically encourage more biodiversity through the flora, but also then through the insects and the birds and all of the fauna that may be enticed to come along. We're throwing, you know, about 5,000 plants into that 1,000 square metre space. So that's kind of unheard of in a landscape design, but it's what you would find in nature. So, you know, when you've got that many plants, once they establish, it goes without saying that you don't have to do as much weeding, because there's just not enough room for the weeds to take hold.
These garden spaces aren't just for looks, but can also be foraged. And whilst they aren't at a commercial farm scale, they do provide a range of benefits.
The urban farming space is somewhere where we can really make a bit of a difference on our environmental footprint, and also, you know, help to cool things down a little bit in our cities as they become greyer and blacker through concrete and bitumen. But the more green and blue spaces we can reincorporate and work with Mother Nature as much as possible, then I think the better off we'll all be. But it's not a farm in so far as, you know, growing produce for their mass consumption. It's way too small for that. And what we've actually found is that it's become more of a beacon for biodiversity rather than, you know, the farm aspects of growing native foods for consumption. Although it does serve that purpose, it's rather minimal in when it's put up against the amount of biodiversity that's coming into such a small space. A lot of modern landscapes, I guess in some ways it's more about the aesthetic rather than the ecological benefit.
Along with the ecological functionality, these green spaces also have great community benefits.
Part of our vision is to encompass education as part of all of the green spaces that we're looking after in that precinct, and bringing in a forageable landscape, showing some of the native plants that can be used medicinally or culinarily. We can, you know, show that there are things that people can grow in their own homes. And, you know, again, apart from those food miles, there's less water required. You know, we're using zero pesticides, herbicides, fungicides. We're using all liquid fertilizers from worm farms. We're doing things that are good for the environment, but also good for people. So we're making a landscape where the plants are, you know, looking after each other. What you would normally find in a normal plant ecosystem is what we're trying to achieve, so that, you know, we can also have smaller pockets of culinary herbs that people are quite used to sitting beside a lot of our native species, so that there is opportunities for people to have these small traditional kitchen gardens, I suppose, in some ways, but small pockets of those interspersed with a fully native and forageable landscape. In the case of South Everleigh Rooftop, for example, it's a community space. It's there to encourage people to come and use the space and to enjoy the space. And then, you know, by extension, learn about some of the plants that are up there and hopefully grow some of them at home. When we look at urban farming, for example, which is becoming more and more prevalent, there's so many studies that have shown that people engaging in nature, people engaging in gardening, for example, and with plants, it helps your mental health, it helps your overall well-being, and just being able to have access to those green spaces, it, you know, it automatically makes people feel better. So these are the type of things that I'm really interested in.
Clarence sees our urban gardens as individual spaces, but also as connected ones. And the key thing is to bring back biodiversity.
You know, I'm certainly not against, you know, aesthetically pleasing spaces, and they don't all have to be 100% native. But that said, our natives are much hardier. They don't, you know, require as much effort. They don't require as much water, all of those things. So to be able to bring back the biodiversity, I think that's the real key in our green spaces. For way too long, it's all been about aesthetics and about fitting into the built environment, whereas we should be switching that to, you know, how can we best encourage biodiversity? How can we best incorporate green spaces into these built spaces so that, you know, it benefits everybody? And as we've mentioned earlier, it, you know, for our own health and well-being, we need to connect with as much green space and as much of nature as we can.
The City of Sydney is one of only a handful of councils across all of Australia that has managed to increase its green canopy over recent years. Most have a decline in measured canopy due to increased development pressure and tree removals. But one company helping to bring back the green with breathing walls and rooftop gardens is Junglefy. Hisham Alameddin is their Estimation, Research and Development Manager.
Junglefy's aim really is to cultivate critical connections between people, places, and plants. What that really means is people have something, there's something called biophilia or a biophilic connection. It's just the connection of people have with plants and with nature in general. And we are trying to introduce the plants into our urban concrete jungles. And the aim really is to get that health and well-being to both the people and also the biodiversity and the climate overall.
There have been many studies done on the benefits of green spaces to human health and well-being, including things around reduced stress and better sleep, and Junglefy incorporating plants into all sorts of functional spaces. One example is their breathing wall.
To put it in simple terms, what a breathing wall is, it's an active airflow green wall. So it's green wall on steroids, let's call it. Basically, what it does is that it takes in pollutants, it traps them in the growing media, which has some bacteria that creates a symbiotic relationship with the plants. And these bacteria eat these pollutants. They are their nutrients. And the plants then feed off the growing media, the breakdown, and the bacteria. Now, what happens as a result is that you're delivering clean air to the indoor environment, and at the same time, other than pollutants, the plants are actively removing CO2. And through the removal of pollutants, of VOCs, of particulate matter, the indoor or tenant or occupant health actually improves.
These breathing green walls are just one way of incorporating plants into our built environment. Another example is the biosolar rooftop.
What a biosolar roof is, it's a green roof combined with solar panels. Now, this was done on the RMU House, Barangaroo. Junglefy did the design, supply, and installation, and even maintenance of the green roof, and then the solar panels were installed.
Junglefy teamed up with the developers, Lendlease and University of Technology Sydney, to test a long-held theory that a green roof could enhance the energy efficiency of solar panels, as well as its positive impact on urban heat, biodiversity, stormwater mitigation, and carbon dioxide reduction.
So the Army House has a nearly identical building, same material, next to it. So this is very rare to be able to have that in an environment, especially in this circumstance, a biosolar roof and a solar roof next to each other in the same location, and to be able to study both. So you have the control and you can have a comparative study. Well, it was a 12-month research project. I believe data collection was roughly 10 months of that. And the results of the research were actually phenomenal. From a biodiversity perspective, the avian species, so birds basically, was 4 times increase on the biosolar roof. And for the insects, a 9-time increase compared to the control roof that doesn't have a green roof. So it's quite phenomenal.
One example of these insects that found a home on the biosolar rooftop was the blue-banded bee, one of our native pollinators.
You don't see many of them, not because they're endangered, however, because they live in isolation or pairs, not in big hives. So seeing a blue-banded bee is actually quite magnificent. They also capture the metallic shield bug, which is also a rare species to find in Barangaroo in the middle of the city. Actually, even on that roof, that's a bit gruesome. We did see a bird that seemed to have been eaten by a predator, birds of prey, which indicates that the whole cycle has been closed. So you have the plants, you have the insects, you have the decomposition, you have the birds that eat the insects, and then you have the birds of prey that eat the birds. So you complete that life cycle, which is actually very exciting. The research has also showed different benefits outside biodiversity. So it increased the efficiency of the solar panels on average 3%, which may not seem like a big number. However, with solar panels, every little bit matters.
In addition to the solar efficiency, the research study found the biosolar rooftop was up to 20 degrees cooler in summer and water outlet flow decreased by 99%. Plants play a vital role in our ecosystem, especially so in our urban environments.
There's plenty of social benefits. There's plenty of well-being that can be done also through breathing technology that Junglefy does. There's a lot of impact that goes as well beyond the green roof. I think green roofs are a good start and we can do more. People want plants. I think that even on balconies, something simple, backyards, they're introducing plants and trying to bring it all together. Everything has an impact. Again, if you're growing certain flowering species that can provide pollen and nectar for the bees, that is extremely valuable. Even though it's a small area, that makes a difference. And it all ties in together. I think the more the city grows, generally speaking, or the wider the diameter, let's say, or the span of the city becomes, the less biodiversity is, the more impact it has, negative impact on biodiversity. I think what we have found is that with the introduction of plants and careful selection of species, you actually encourage biodiversity. So I think with cities and biodiversities, it's a very fine balance. And as populations grow, as densities grow, it's just becoming more of a pressure on biodiversity to try to keep up. And we're losing a lot there.
We are all part of the urban ecosystem and can create a wildlife refuge in our surrounding environment. If you have an outdoor patch at home or at work, you can be part of the solution to creating habitat. From logs with holes in them to a few flowers, you can make a difference because a greater diversity of plants tends to result in a greater variety of animals living in the garden. And together, we can all participate in growing a resilient city.
I think we can do more. The more we can introduce plants into the urban environment, the more we can try to soften the blow of concrete and of materials that really do not have much of an improvement to our urban jungle. And even this does extend beyond the urban jungle. I think the future to us would look like plants everywhere, on all buildings, every nook. I think that is the vision.
This podcast has been produced by the Grow Love Project, with support from the New South Wales Government's Saving Our Species program. To hear more episodes, make sure to subscribe to this podcast. And for more info about the Saving Our Species program, visit savingourspecies.online/podcast. Thanks for listening.